Keita, 13h et 16h. Match illégal, on va pas bouger, tu comprends ça. C'est Salif Keita et l'escadrille. Match illégal, on va pas bouger, tu comprends pas.
Welcome to the third in our series of podcasts and radio programs broadcast with Afrobeats Radio on WBAI 99.5 FM New York, listener-sponsored community radio. This program has been developed on behalf of a network called Environmental Justice Organizations, Liabilities and Trade, or EJOLT for short. My name is Firoz Manji, and I've been talking with a number of activists across the world about their work on environmental justice, the involvement of communities, and the effects of mining, land grabbing, carbon trading, and environmental degradation on their lives. Today I caught up with Professor Alf Hornberg, who is Professor of Human Ecology at Lund University in Sweden. He has been one of the leading people involved in EJOLT. Alf Hornberg has conducted field research in Peru, Nova Scotia, and the Kingdom of Tonga and Brazil. He has published widely on the cultural and political dimensions of the interrelationships between humans and the environment, looked at from the perspective of the world systems analysis. He is well known as a theorist of what is called ecologically unequal exchange. Thanks very much for coming on the show. We're discussing the whole issue of what is meant by ecological justice and environmental justice. And you're probably best known for being the theorist of what is called ecologically unequal exchange in the world today. I think a lot of people would find that phrase quite difficult to understand. So I was wondering if we could start with asking you to give us an idea about what ecologically unequal exchange is all about.
Right. Well, let's begin by observing that conventional economics really doesn't recognize an equal exchange at all. I mean, fundamentally, a market transaction where people buy and sell commodities or services on the market is almost by definition equal, because there's always a monetary value, a money price put on your goods and services, which basically you will be paid, and so that's the end of the matter. What I'm arguing is that, so to speak, underneath these price tags, we can see other kinds of metrics, other measures of real resources that are being exchanged in the world in highly unequal ways. And this will not be obvious for the economist looking only at the monetary price tags. But we can show that what looks like very equal exchanges on the market is really highly unequal in terms of the investments, for example, of land, the number of hectares of land that have been used to produce a certain commodity, or the number of hours of labor that have been invested to produce a commodity. If you look at the invested land and the invested labor in commodities, then much of the exchange we have in the world today is highly unequal.
That's a point that Samir Amin has put in his writings about unequal exchange. And that's certainly true in terms of trade relationships between the global south and the north. But when we're talking about ecologically unequal exchange, are you talking about the fact that some of the impact on the environment, the ecology on land, on the biological environment, is there an unequal exchange in that?
Yeah, I think a very obvious example would be the export of cotton textiles from Britain in the year 1850, the mid-19th century. According to an economist, the trade of British textiles in exchange for cotton fiber, for example, from the Caribbean and the southern states of North America would seem quite symmetric and fair. But if you quantify the amounts of land that were embodied, so to speak, in the two main commodities flowing across the Atlantic, the cotton fiber versus the finished cotton textiles, then you can show, as I've done, that England traded the produce of about 1 hectare of British land against the produce of about 58 hectares of land in the colonies.
But some might argue that what you're arguing is that what economists would call externalities should be commodified, should be given a monetary value. Isn't that what the argument of the World Bank is?
It's a very misleading argument because it's obvious that industrialism or industrial capitalism, if you will, would be unable to cover the external costs, so to speak, of its own economic processes. If you would seriously put a price on ecosystem services or on environmental destruction, as some people argue, then I don't think industrialism would be profitable business. Nobody would engage in it because the whole point with capitalism is to keep the externalities external. In other words, is not to pay the costs of the disorder that industrial capitalism creates in its global periphery.
So, for example, you would say that actually if the oil companies in the Niger Delta were forced to pay for the destruction of the environment, the poisoning of water, the removal of populations from the destruction of the environment and so on, if that was actually built into the cost of producing oil, then it would actually not be profitable at all.
Exactly, that's what I would mean. We also have to question the very notion of putting a price on kinds of things that you just mentioned. A price is a cultural category that we have invented. It really denotes an exchange relation. A price means very different things to different people, depending on how much money they have. The people who can afford to pay, so to speak, for their destruction of the environment can continue to do so. They can continue to destroy the environment. So pricing it will not save the environment, only make it a privilege of the wealthy to continue destroying it.
So what's the alternative?
The alternative is to really seriously, radically question the whole idea and concept of general purpose money. I'm an anthropologist, so I use the concept of general purpose money to distinguish the money that we now have in most of the world, which makes all commodities basically interchangeable on the market, from what we in anthropology call special purpose money, that is money that has a more restricted use in exchanging certain kinds of commodities and services for certain other kinds of commodities and services. I could give some ethnographic examples, of course, but I hope the point is clear.
Well, I'd quite like to get more clarity on that. You've argued, for example, that there should be two types of currencies which can't be exchanged with each other. Let's take, you know, oil production in the Niger Delta as an example. How would this operate?
Well, let me begin by saying that even if it sounds very far-fetched at the moment, the idea of having two separate currencies, one global and one local, is beginning to be discussed in countries that have really faced some of the worst problems of financial crisis. For example, in Greece, I have several students here in Lund who actually come from Greece, and they're very familiar with the idea. In fact, the idea of a local currency is a strategy that is seriously proposed in Greece as a means of safeguarding people's survival. And we can only go back a couple of decades to Argentina when the Argentinian economy broke down. One of the first things that happened was that people invented their own local currency called créditos, which not only made it easier for people to survive, but which also recreated a sense of community that Argentina hadn't experienced for a long time up to then.
And that currency, you're saying, wasn't exchangeable on an international level?
Well, I would say that none of the experiments we have seen so far with local currencies have really been grounded in a thorough analysis of the problem with general purpose money. We have, for example, a huge number of so-called LETS economies, local exchange trading systems, but these systems generally do not limit the applicability of the currency, the local currency, only actually it's the geographical range. I mean, the Brixton pound, for example, is to be used by people living in the Brixton area, but there is nothing said about what kinds of goods it should be used for. So there's nothing really that would stop anyone from buying commodities from the United States or from China with the same currency. Now, the point with my idea is that this is the most important aspect of it, that the local currency should be local not only in terms of who use it, but also in terms of what it is used for, in order to make items of locally produced food, for example, non-exchangeable with long-distance technological exports from the States or China.
But isn't that problem rooted in what happened in the 1970s with the delinking of the dollar from the gold standard and the subsequent situation in which everything, including debt repayment, is valued, or rather priced, against the US dollar? So you have a hegemony of the US dollar. Isn't that the source of the problem?
It's definitely one of the sources. The abandonment of the gold standard in the 1970s was a component in a longer historical drift of money towards more and more abstract forms. We have seen the shift from bullion to paper money, from paper money to electronic blips on a computer screen, and so on. And the abandonment of the gold standard was certainly a step in that direction, making money more and more abstract and disconnected from actual biophysical processes. As long as money was limited by the amount of gold that could be stored in the Pentagon or whatever, there was some kind of material constraint on how much money could be printed. But today, of course, money is basically a figment of our imagination, and that is the reason why financial bubbles keep bursting all around us.
Yes, the new term called quantitative easing is just a printing of more money, essentially, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And so far, the financial crisis that we have seen so much discussion and deliberation about over the past few years, it seems to me that the only solution that people seem to come up with is to print more money and increase your debt, which of course cannot be a long-term solution.
Yes. Let me turn to something which I think has captured the imagination of the public, especially since Rio and Rio Plus 20, the Copenhagen conference and so on. You know, people are beginning to get very concerned about environmental destruction and its impact on climate change. And we've heard recently so much information coming out about really serious problems in terms of climate change. And the World Bank and the international financial institutions and the northern governments have sort of picked up on this and talked about green capitalism. They're saying the green economy, that this is what they are going for. I look at adverts in newspapers, on television and so on. The green economy, everyone, including the oil companies, promote the green economy. Isn't that a good thing?
Well, I think it's good in the sense that a lot of people are acknowledging the problems of industrial capitalism. But I would argue that the mainstream recipes for solving these problems are basically not to be taken seriously. They are ideological cover-ups, mystifying the real problems. And the real problems, I think, go back about 200 years to the early years of the Industrial Revolution, and the entire misunderstanding or misconception about what technology really is that we saw emerging in that context in Britain in the early 19th century.
So help us understand, you know, what's wrong with the way in which currently the media and mainstream thinking talks about the green economy?
Because the economic processes, as was shown in 1971 by the economist Georgescu Rogan, the economy is about producing exchange values or utility. I will agree with mainstream economists about that. But what Georgescu Rogan showed was that in the process of producing consumer values, things that we want to buy in the shops, if we really take seriously the second law of thermodynamics, the so-called entropy law, the economic processes inevitably generate entropy or disorder. In other words, we dissipate energy and matter as we produce consumer values. There is a biophysical material aspect to the economy that mainstream economists do not take into consideration, and in fact they do not have the training to do so, because in their studies in economics there is no thermodynamics.